This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. There's plenty of good science to show why we need to regulate industry in its release of toxins into our air and water. Our high-tech society carries with it the danger of making our planet uninhabitable, and in the meantime, we could make ourselves very sick. So to survive, we have to regulate our actions. But questions about how we treat the Earth are not new. I have two guests with me today who've thought about the role religion has played in shaping our understanding of environmental responsibility. Steve Jurovics is the author of the book Hospitable Planet, Faith, Action, and Climate Change. He reads at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham later this month and is with us now. Steve, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Also joining me is Norman Wurzbub, a professor of theology, ecology, and agrarian studies at Duke Divinity School. He's written a number of books. His latest is called From Nature to Creation, A Christian Vision for Understanding and Loving Our World. Norman, welcome. Good to have you here as well.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
Steve, I want to start with you and your book. You focus on Genesis and how we've interpreted the very early passages in Genesis and how that interpretation has really shaped our understanding of our relationship with nature. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there are two parts of it. First of all, the environmental teachings that I talk about in the book really come from Genesis through Deuteronomy because they are all through what Jesus called the law. But I do focus a lot on the sort of prevailing interpretation of Genesis 1:28, which is the verse that says, "Master the earth and have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and all the animals that move on the earth." And the interpretation seems to be that it's all ours, okay? It all belongs to us. We rule it, do what we want. And that's not, I believe, a correct interpretation. And that I tried to demonstrate that throughout the book. And in the first place it falls apart, I believe, is in the Noah story, where I kind of cite a verse that indicates that Noah had no latitude about what to do. He was not ruling anything. He did what God commanded him to do. And then there are verse after verse through the other five books that kind of go into that. So I deal with that one a lot. Because if we did feel that the earth was all ours, then it's hard to persuade something that they need to do something differently. But
that language is pretty clear, and it's what we've been dealing with. I mean, even if you take a film like Evan Almighty, right?
Yes.
The fine film Evan Almighty, which proves that, in fact, we were given dominion over the earth.
Yes.
Man needs to dominate creatures. Oh, and ultimately, man must dictate what happens in this country. God bless America.
There we go. Proof. Now, there's an interpretation.
Yes, there is.
But you're saying that really, and it comes very early in the book, but you're saying there's lots of passages that follow that suggest we have more responsibility.
Yeah, and for example, we have a passage in Genesis 9 after the flood where God says, "I give you all this for food, just as I gave you the plants and the greens, I give now all of this for you for food." And so it's very clear. Yes, it's all of ours for food. But then you get to Leviticus 11, and there are 30 instructions about we can and we cannot eat. So, you know, is it contradicting it, or is it simply the way writing was done 3,000 years ago? But it's very risky to take a verse at one point and then run with it and say, well, that applies to the whole five books.
Norman, you actually start way back and you take a look at the term nature itself and how that term itself has placed us on some pretty treacherous territory, right?
Yeah, I think the first thing I want people to know is that there's nothing natural about the word nature, right? That nature has meant many, many different kinds of things throughout the years. And if you look, for instance, in the ancient world, nature simply talked about the inner principles that allow things to be what they are. And that's something internal to things. But later on, you know, in the modern period, nature comes to represent this amoral, sort of value-free arena in which people can do with things whatever they want. And so how ancient Greeks might have thought about nature is actually reversed in the modern period, because to an ancient Greek way of thinking, things are tending to fulfill themselves, and so they have a kind of integrity. But when you come to the modern period, there is no integrity within things. They're all just valueless lump, perhaps. And so people can do with things what they want, and so impose their desires upon the world. That's a radically different conception of nature. And then there are just many, many more versions of nature besides.
But where is it in the Judeo-Christian text that prohibits humans from using it the way they want? I mean, isn't the gloss on this, look, these are our gifts from God. Our minds and our ability to manipulate nature is one of those gifts. Aren't we ordered to use that gift and manipulate technology and nature in a way that makes us happy? Wasn't that God's intention?
Well, I think there are lots of ways to suggest that that's a misreading and a misunderstanding of what's happening in scriptural passages, because one fundamental conception that's operative throughout Scripture is that the land belongs to God. So conceptions about private property, or even conceptions about our unlimited access and acquisition of land, is constantly being met with breaks, right? God is saying, no, you can't do this. So, for instance, one of the most radical economic teachings that you get is called the Jubilee. And it's in a book called Leviticus that not a whole lot of people spend a lot of time with. But it's a teaching that says, look, after 50 years, if as a person, your family lost access to land, because land is the means of a person's and a family's livelihood, if you lost access to that land, you had to maybe go into slavery yourself or some kind of indentured servitude. It became reversed so that the land went back to families because people need to have access to land. Or then think later on in the prophetic literature where the prophets rail against the kinds of profiteers that want to simply acquire more and more land. And so the consolidation of land into the hands of a few very, very wealthy people is strictly prohibited and condemned, because when you do that, you create the unjust orders that don't simply harm human society, they also harm the land. And that's exactly what we're seeing today with the consolidation of land, is that the land is being mistreated, the waters are being mistreated, and as a result, we find ourselves in a really difficult spot.
Well, Steve, those are some of the qualifications, again, that you talk about from the initial initial injunction to dominate the earth, all of these proscriptions around that to modify and be careful about it. But the fact is that Jesus and his antecedents and ancestors didn't look at global warming. That was not a problem. And many of the problems that we face today were not faced by those who are featured in the scriptures. Steve, is it even right or fair to use those texts to talk about what's happening today?
Well, I think that what we have to do anytime we read the Bible and we try to see how it applies to a current problem is to sort of pull it forward in time and say, what's the heart of this teaching and how does it apply to our issue, our level of knowledge? So when people looked at this text in 1216, they were drawing it out with the knowledge that we knew had in 1216 and the problems they had at that point. When we do this in 2016, again, we're looking at it with fresh eyes with our individual problems. So what I tried to do in the book is to take that sort of the heart of the teaching and say, how does it apply to our current problem? And that's kind of the challenge. And I think that, as Norbert said, Leviticus has a lot about how to treat the land. And there are lots of restrictions about that. Basically, God says, I'll make a deal with you. Okay, if the land belongs to me, and you can use it, but you need to take care of the needy and the stranger, and the widow and the orphan. That's kind of the deal. And so there are lots of verses about, you know, don't cut the corners of your fields and must be left for the needy and so on. So there, as you can say, there are lots of breaks put in the text that indicate how we are to deal with the text. And I think the people of Jesus' time were living that way. We have some evidence that they were.
Well, and you also encourage, in your book, you encourage people to look at the Bible that Jesus knew when he was interpreting Scripture, try to understand what he was looking at.
Right, right. I think that is really important, because when we talk about creation, we immediately think we're talking about Genesis, and that's where we need to look. But the rest of the five books, Genesis through Deuteronomy, are the place where we find instructions about our interactions with the natural world. That's where they are really given. I mean, the people who wrote the Gospels and the Epistles were Jews. For them, they had the law, just as Jesus referred to the law and the prophets. There was no intent, I believe, to replace the law. That was there. And so we need to, if we're talking about issues involving the natural world, I think we need to look at the text that are dealing with that.
Tell us about, Norman, your method and process for interpreting the texts.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you that it would be a mistake to think that there's an environmental consciousness or something like that in the time of the biblical composition. But I think it's also a mistake to believe that people in the ancient worlds were not aware of ecological degradation. So Plato, for instance, spoke about how deforestation was contributing to soil erosion. And this is something that people who work closely with the land, and this is important to remember, that the people who lived in the biblical period, many of them were subsistence farmers. And as a subsistence farmer, you're very attuned to ecological rhythms, even if you don't have the vocabulary for that. And you know that because you're working with very close margins, you have to understand that people can make mistakes. And when they make mistakes, there's serious damage to the family, but also to the land. And so what I would say when reading Scripture is you don't look for environmental principles so much as you look to see how Scripture is trying to help us understand the nature of humanity, how we as human beings behave, and how cultures can become the sorts of cultures that produce damage and injustice. And so for me, environmental problems, they're not simply technical issues. They're fundamentally questions about who we understand ourselves to be and what is appropriate behavior in our world. Because we can be the kinds of people who simply rape and pillage and mine, or we can be the kinds of people who take care and celebrate the gifts of the world that are around us. And I think scriptural traditions and certainly other faith traditions have a whole lot to say about what kinds of people are best trained to be the sorts of people who create a beautiful, livable world.
But as you suggest, even in your meditation on the word nature and how that has given us a kind of an unbalanced sense or a dualistic sense of our place and nature, it's us and them.
Right.
Creature is another one of those words that, again, puts some distance between us and the wholeness of the world that we live in.
Yeah, see, I think here, too, you have to be careful how you use a word like creation or creature, because these words, too, can mean different things at different times. And one of the things that I'm trying to suggest is that the language of creatureliness is actually in Scripture developed as a way of joining intimately the lives of human beings with animals, plants, and soil. So, for instance, in Genesis 2, where we have the Garden of Eden story, what's fascinating about that story is, first of all, it presents God as a gardener. So those notions of God that you might have of God being distant and uninterested and mostly angry at us, they just don't obtain in this story at all, because instead of a God who's distant, you have God as a gardener presented as one who is holding soil in God's hands, kissing it and breathing the life into it that makes us as people, right, this Adam, this first human being, but it's also responsible for the kind of life that is the plant life and animal life. And so soil becomes this matrix that joins plant, animal, human life together into this garden scene, which all together produces beauty and produces nutrition. It's a striking vision, because what it does is it locates human beings on the ground with other creatures. We're all in it together.
When you do all that work, of course, you can see the unity in all of it. But Steve, I'll put this question to you first and come back to you, Norman. Isn't there something inherently dualistic about the way the Judeo-Christian the tradition has come to us, the idea of a chosen people, a kind of exceptionalism about humanity? It is something other than. Isn't that inherent in this tradition? And isn't that something we're, in a sense, you'd have to work against?
Well, to some degree, and certainly there is, in the common discussion, there is something about the chosenness, although many Jews say, you know, we've been chosen to get this text and to work with it, and that's all we've been chosen for. So I think there's a sort of rejection of that popular notion of what that means. But
an exceptionalism, that humans are somehow in the text exceptional, so other than or beyond what are the other.
Yeah, I think that certainly is the perception. But what I kind of point out is that first covenant in there is made with all life on earth, about the covenant after the flood. And it's very clear that it repeats many times, I make this covenant with all life on earth. Okay, it makes it with all the animals, all the birds, all the fish. It's made with all, not just with us. And I think that that's very powerful, that is the first covenant that's stated, and it is with all life on earth, not just us. And there are commentators who look and say, well, you know, we're not really that terrific because we were created last. you know, maybe last isn't so good. Now, somebody will look at it and say, well, but we were the ultimate or whatever. So, you know, there are various perspectives on this that are taken in terms of our exceptional nature.
Norman? Yeah, I think here you have to be careful about traditions of interpretation so that, for instance, there are traditions of interpretation in theology, for instance, that are more dualistic, and often they are under the influence of extra philosophical kinds of systems like Platonic philosophy, for instance, and other traditions that are not so susceptible to these kinds of influences, and I would suggest speak in a more scriptural kind of anthropology. So, I would just echo with Stephen, right? Think about a book like Job in the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible, where the whole point of this book, well, not just one point, there are many being made, but one of the major points is to reposition humanity so that they do not think they are the center of the universe, that it's all for them. And so in one of the speeches that God makes, and God doesn't make big, long speeches in Scripture, but in Job, God does. And what God does is basically blast Job and says, why should you think I only care about you? In fact, I care about all the creatures. I pay attention to creatures that don't even enter your mind or your imagination. And I even love the creatures that would kill you if you got near them. So there's a kind of repositioning that is happening throughout Scripture to precisely head off the kind of exceptionalism which positions us somehow outside the world of other creatures or outside the world of creation, that then gives us a license to do with it whatever we want. Because I would say, if there is a kind of exceptionalism, it is an exceptionalism of responsibility.
And Steve, if the question is, what's religion got to do with it anyway, you point to the civil rights movement and the connection between religion and social justice.
Yes, I'm really looking to the civil rights movement as a model for how we can push for change in society, because the part two of the book lists 10 measures that I think would significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions, very dramatically reduce them. And then the question is, how do we implement these? How do we push for them to be done? And so the civil rights movement, I think, is a model for it. I'm kind of calling for an environmental rights movement that's modeled on that, in which we really push in the two ways that Martin Luther King did. I think he addressed the moral issue when he went into churches and he gave speeches. He discussed about how we are all equal before God. But then there were also the marches and the demonstrations that were for equal rights and equal housing and equal education. And I think we need to do the same thing here. We kind of need to see this as both a religious issue as well as an environmental issue.
Norman, do we run the risk, though, because religion has a lot of functions? One, it helps us to understand or at least deal with our inability to understand the big questions, and mm-hmm. so it has a deep philosophical, moral aspect to it. But also it's an identity, and identity becomes a problem in trying to find out a solution. We all agree there should be clean air, but if you associate the push for clean air with the other party, then you're opposed to it, and
right.
you stop thinking.
Yeah, it's a really difficult matter to get through, and I think one of the ways that we might try to move forward is to get people to ask the questions that are fundamentally personal and close to home, right? Ask questions about what kind of a world do you want for your children or your grandchildren, or what kind of a world would promote the flourishing of creatures together? Because when you do it that way and you get to people's fundamental commitments, I think it's going to be very hard to come across people who will say, yeah, I really don't care if my grandchildren have a world that's inhabitable. I think that gets more difficult to defend. And so what you want to do is, I think, engage people on these levels of fundamental commitments that we have. And then you work to, well, what are the policy or the economic changes that follow from these fundamental commitments? But once we get some clarity on what those are, then we can start working together about how we might have some solutions that will alleviate some of our troubles. And this becomes then not just an interpersonal but also an interfaith. I mean, everybody needs to be at the table because everybody has something to contribute, a perspective, a vantage point from which to see how we are either doing good things or how we're doing damage.
I want to thank you both for being on the program today, Norman Wurzba and Steve Jurovics. Steve is the author of Hospitable Planet, Faith, Action, and Climate Change, and he's going to read at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham later this month. We've got that information at our website. Steve, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much.
Norman Wurzba is a professor of theology, ecology, and agrarian studies at Duke Divinity School, author of a number of books, the latest, From Nature to Creation, A Christian Vision for Understanding and Loving Our World. Norman, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up on The State of Things, you will hear tales from a local storytelling event, the Monty, in its 8th year. Stay with us.